This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the eighth in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very happy to have with me today Brian Chess. Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Gary.
Brian is the co-founder and chief scientist of Fortify Software, purveyors of fine software security tools. Brian has lived on both sides of the academic-commercial divide, having completed his static analysis PhD at UC Santa Cruz after several years building commercial software. Now he's busy putting what he learned to good use in the Fortify toolset. Brian lives in Silicon Valley with his wife and his new baby, Simon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gary.
You have worked as a commercial software guy and as an academic researcher. So what do those two distinct sets of people have to learn from each other?
Oh, boy. Well, I'll tell you the first thing that I learned after I finished my PhD, and that was people in the commercial world actually care about security. Now, I don't know if that was always true, but it certainly was true after I finished my PhD in 2002. So let me think. So the other half of that is what do the people in commercial world have to learn from the academics? Well, I'll tell you, I think a lot of people in the commercial world are just sort of starting to wake up to software security as a discipline. And it turns out people have been doing work in the academic world and security for quite a long time. So there's a pretty good and developed history of you know, security work out there. Oh, I mean, take a look at Matt Bishop's book, Computer Security, Art and Science. There's quite a bit of literature out there to go and get started on solving your security problems.
So do you think that these two sets of people speak the same language? Do they think the same way, or...
Yeah. Oh, you know, absolutely not. That's a really good point. So the academic folks are busy solving academic problems, and the commercial folks a lot of times don't know that what they're doing actually has already been done before. So I think there's plenty of room there for interaction between the two. You know, I think that was one of the great things about this last USENIX Security Symposium, where you dragged in a bunch of commercial folks to talk to the academics. And I saw a lot of eyebrows going up as the academics found out, oh, wait, you commercial folks, you actually care about some of these security problems?
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. How about the other way around? The commercial guys certainly produce a lot more software, and you might argue that some of the software they produce is better than, say, the prototype code or little test programs that academics use in some of their research.
Well, you know, that's certainly true. I mean, just taking Fortify as an example here. So I built a static analysis tool when I was a PhD student, and now I've been building one in the commercial world. And what I can do in the commercial world is have a room full of 20 engineers sit down for literally years and flesh out ideas and actually make a robust commercial product out of it, whereas really all I could do in the academic arena was prove that an idea was possible. And that's one of the things I really wanted to, after I was finished with an engineering PhD, what I wanted to do was go out and engineer something. So, I mean, it's been an amazing opportunity in that sense.
So it has to be pretty exciting working in a Kleiner Perkins startup, what with their previous tiny little companies like Google and Amazon and Sun and others.
Well, I'll tell you, working for Kleiner Perkins is a little like borrowing money from the mob. they want to see something in exchange for their investment, so that's a fair amount of pressure. On the other hand,
how long have you guys been at it? Been doing that thing, and how's it going?
We're coming up on 4 years, and it's going really well. So this is the second long stint that I've spent at a startup, and the first time around started in like 98. And so we really got up a good head of steam just about as the dot-com bubble burst. And so I know what it's like to be working on a startup when there is no wind in the sails.
Mm-hmm.
And this time around is very, very different. So every year we sort of get together, the founders, that is, get together and look back, and what we see is way, way more excitement in the industry than we as a startup company could possibly be putting there.
So there's that's one aspect of your job that's probably interesting to a lot of listeners here. You know, you guys touch a lot of customers that are doing software security because that happens to be the market that you're serving. So one obvious question is, which of your many Fortify customers is doing the best job with software security? Like, what's the state of the art as far as you're seeing in terms of applying these tools?
Boy, you know, I'll tell you, one of the problems with working in the security realm is the customers don't necessarily like you to use their names all the
time. I know, that's why I ask you. I'm just putting you on the spot.
And I'll tell you, I would say the people who are doing the best job of applying the tools that we give them are in the financial services sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's because they started a little bit before everyone else or if they're a little more serious about it, maybe because they've got a lot of regulations that they need to comply with.
So instead of worrying about names of the companies, what are they doing that's so good? Like what makes one, say, application or installation of Fortify or any other static analysis tool better than another?
I'll tell you what I think that they're doing that puts them ahead of the pack, and that is they measure. So they don't just run the tools and find some bugs and fix them and feel good about themselves. They look and they say, well, what percentage of all of the findings that we had did we get through the tools? And how could we increase that by 20% over the next year? And then they go back, and because they keep all of the history of all of the bugs they've ever found, they can go back and they can look for trends. And they could say, huh, you know, if the tool could find this particular problem, if it could find, oh, you know, input validation mistakes coming over our web services interface, then all of a sudden we could meet that 20% findings goal. And then they come back to us and they say, hey, how can you help us do this? And that's very, very rewarding for me because, you know, not only are they happy with the tool, but they help me move the tool forward in terms of what its capabilities are.
Okay, and then on the flip side, what is the silliest or most ridiculous application of the tool set that you've seen out there?
Well, you know, I would say this applies to security in general. Security applies almost everywhere, software security in particular. If you're building a piece of software these days, security is gonna matter, but a lot of times people don't want to necessarily face the security problem. They want to deal with whatever business problem that they're trying to solve.
Well, some of them want to just sprinkle magic crypto fairy dust on it.
That's
and call
exactly
it a day.
Where I'm going. Is they want some sort of magic talisman that they can buy or build or somehow wave over their code and say that it's blessed. And unfortunately, you can do that with just about any security product out there, including the stuff that we make. So you can say, hey, I bought a static analysis tool, and therefore now I am secure.
Mm-hmm.
And oops, wait a minute, you have to actually run the tool and pay attention to what it tells you before you can improve your security state.
So it's kind of either wishful thinking or the silver bullet syndrome.
So the whole idea that I can just buy the tool, put it on the shelf, and that makes me somehow more secure is the silliest way that people apply tools.
Yeah, you know, there didn't used to be a security silver bullet until we made one.
well, you know, actually...
And you're talking on it.
you know, Gary, actually, I went back and read a silver bullet article. I'm not sure where you decided to pull the title from.
Brooks, really.
Brooks has got an article named No Silver Bullet.
Yeah.
And he goes through, you know, I love that article. It doesn't talk about security at all, though. But he tries to break down whether what the nature of programming problems are. And mm-hmm. He divides them into essential programming problems and non-essential or non-integral programming problems. So, like, for instance, software is complicated. And that has nothing to do with your programming language. It has nothing to do with the environment that you work in. Software is just complicated stuff. On the other hand, there are a bunch of problems out there that are completely incidental to what you're trying to build. You know, I think buffer overflow is a good example, right? So buffer overflow is a big problem in C and C++, and that's completely an artifact of early design decisions people made in those languages. It doesn't have to be that way, as you know, .NET, C# proves, or as Java proves. But then you get to this interesting question, which is, are software security problems essential? Are you always going to have software security problems? Or are they all just accidents of the implementations of the languages or the frameworks that we use?
Mm-hmm. I think that some of your work has shown that they kind of persist over time in interesting ways.
Well, I'll tell you what my answer to this is, which is software security problems almost always manifest themselves as accidents. Right, so in C and C++, it might be buffer overflow.
Hey, speaking of the buffer overflow thing, were you at that software security workshop we ran at DIMAX a few years ago?
Nope, I wasn't.
I think that was slightly before you got...
It was.
...started doing Fortify. So around 2001, one of the most hilarious things that happened was we got Kernighan to give a talk about beautiful code and style and trying to do things right, and we were trying to get to the bottom of the question that you're pondering right now. You know, is it the language? What causes all this? And of course, some smart guy at the end said, "Hey, that's a great talk about style, but what about those terrible string handling functions you guys put in C?" And a lot of us sort of, you know, sat back wondering what he was going to say. And without blinking an eyelash, he said, "Oh yeah, that was Dennis's code."
Oh, that's brilliant.
Very
that's
clever.
So, you know, but you find that in other languages too. I mean, you look at just about any language that's been adopted for use on the web, and, you know, just take the first example out of the first book you pull off your bookshelf on programming that language, and I bet you it's got a cross-site scripting problem in it.
So a perfect example of that is Ajax, which is very hot. You know, that's the web development technology behind something like Google Maps. But, you know, you point out in some of previous podcasts that you've done, or at least, I don't know what those things were, little video things, that there are problems like cross-site scripting that are very similar in nature to the buffer overflow, since we're just talking about running some code you shouldn't be running. So that
Gary,
calls
does this
the
mean
question.
You actually watch videos over the web?
Yeah. Have we learned anything since the Morris worm? What do you think? I was learning from Dr. Chess, man. He's on TV.
I'll tell you, the evidence is pretty thin to try and support the idea that we've learned. So this whole deal with cross-site scripting, and I still run into people who kind of want to blow off cross-site scripting and say, "Eh, well, so what? So you got a problem, and somebody else can send your users their JavaScript and have them execute it." Dude, so help me associate the name with this quote. Once the bad guy can run code on your machine, it isn't your machine anymore. And, you know, if they can run arbitrary code, that's great. But if all they can do is run JavaScript, it turns out there's quite a bit of bad stuff they can do. So this whole idea that it's okay to allow applications to have cross-site scripting vulnerabilities is just mystifying to me. Because it basically is the same sort of thing. It allows arbitrary code execution on your machine. And those web browsers aren't set up with any sort of security model to tell you whether or not a JavaScript event is the result of somebody taking an action, or if it's just some code that happened to manage to land in the browser. So that Ajax problem is looking really, really sticky. It's actually my favorite for the replacement for the buffer overflow.
Yep.
So have you seen the CVE guys say there are now more cross-site scripting issues reported to them than buffer overflow issues reported to them? And I think that's the way things are going to go.
So these web languages, you know, and other things, they have interesting new properties, but they also have old problems. And, you know, you're trying to relate these two things together, I suppose.
So the question in my mind is, so is software security, going back to the way Brooks phrases it, is software security an essential problem or is it an incidental problem? And I think, if nothing else, the web offers another hint that maybe all of these things just look like bugs in your program, or maybe they look like design flaws in your program. But does that make software security essential or not? To my way of thinking, whenever you come across one of these problems, it doesn't look essential because there's always some way to dig your way out of the security trap. But I don't know that we're ever going to find a context or a programming language or set of tools where software security isn't a problem. In other words, we're always going to have this software security problem with us. We're always going to have to be facing it.
So we have to start doing something maybe slightly different about it than inventing new languages, like best practices and better tools and things like that.
So there's no way to get out of making software security part of the software development process.
You and I have spent many hours talking about software security just like this. And in particular, my favorite were the river sessions where you and I were sitting in the Shenandoah River talking about this. And I really appreciate your help getting the stuff in software security formulated. But what do you think the number one software security best practice is that everybody should be doing today?
Well, I'll tell you, Gary, if I just sort of parachuted into an organization and I couldn't, and I had to do just one thing, they were doing nothing related to software security at all,
mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, the first thing that I would do is try to do some measurement. Where the heck are we with respect to software security? Do the customers care about it? Are the customers going to care about it next week? When we have security problems, who finds them? Do people find them when they're doing the QA process? That's not very likely, but it could happen. Or are the customers reporting everything to me? Once I can get a measurement system in place, then I can try and change something and then figure out whether it actually affected my software security posture or not.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So once I had a little bit of measurement in place, I've got to say, I don't know if it'll sound funny coming from me or not, but I think code review is the way to go. Mm-hmm. Now you might say, oh, yeah, of course he says that because he works for this company and makes this code review tool. But I'll tell you, I've thought that, I started thinking that in about 1995 when I started working on a PhD in this stuff.
I agree with you about that. You know, I think there are sort of two top best practices. Code review is one, and then the other one is obviously architectural risk analysis. But they both are the same thing, looking for defects in your software and then trying to eradicate them.
So the reason I get started with code review rather than risk analysis is that it's easier to do.
You bet.
It's easier to see a little bit of progress and maybe get some people excited about it.
And the tools are way better. We don't have any for risk analysis.
Well, gosh. Yeah, I'll tell you, risk analysis is a tough one because what you get with the code analysis tools is that there are these some things, we've talked about a few of them, buffer overflow, cross-site scripting, and it doesn't really matter what your program is supposed to do, it shouldn't have that kind of junk in it because it's going to be a security problem.
So it's really more related to syntax than it is semantics.
It is. You get into some issues of semantics, but they're the lower level semantics.
Mm-hmm.
When you start thinking about risk analysis, usually you got to start talking about sort of the higher level semantics of what does the program do, and how is it supposed to achieve its ends, and how might it be thwarted.
That's when you need a high price consultant. Absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you, it's very, very hard to give a tool enough context in order to get that kind of stuff right. So I think it is much more essentially a problem that's going to be solved by humans, whether it's a high-priced consulting human or not, than it is something that we're going to see a lot of automation around.
Mm-hmm. So are you basically, after having been in the commercial space doing software security for 4 years, optimistic or pessimistic about things that are going on in the field?
I'm optimistic that we're going to get rid of big classes of really, really brain-dead errors. So I think, well, like for instance, you look at the black box scanning tools.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual today for people to run a black box scanning, web scanning tool against the application and come back with a whole long list of things that are wrong with that application.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can fix that. I think we can make it so that software security errors aren't quite so blatant.
I would agree with you there. You know, I call those things badnessometers, but I think that they're valuable in a sense that if you don't know that you're in bad shape, having a badnessometer around is very, very helpful. The thing that worries me is if somebody runs a badnessometer and it says, well, you don't have any of these really insanely stupid problems, that doesn't mean you're secure.
You know, I think this is going to go a lot of the same way that software testing has gone,
mm-hmm.
which is when finding bugs is easy, then nobody tries to do anything very clever to find new bugs.
Right.
Once all the easy bugs are gone, then people will start saying, what sort of clever thing could I do in order to start finding bugs?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'll start to see more of the methodology that's been applied to software testing in general be applied to security software testing.
Oh, man, we'd love to see that. But
you know, there are some really basic tools to be applied there, too, like, for instance, code coverage.
Yeah.
So when
the bad guys use that pretty effectively.
But you know, you hired your fancy consultant or you bought your fancy tool and you ran it against your application. How much of your code did you actually run?
Yeah.
Now, you know, you might not figure out how much of it did you test thoroughly, but if the answer comes back they only ran 20% of the code, then you got a pretty good idea you didn't do a good job at testing it.
Yep. So right now you are both raising a tiny baby and writing a book. Are you crazy?
Well, I'll tell you, Gary, I had it all timed just perfectly so that the book would be finished at roughly the same instance that the baby would appear. And the baby was very cooperative around that front. The baby showed up just about the time the baby was supposed to show up.
Uh-huh.
The book, on the other hand, was a whole lot less cooperative.
So
we're doing everything we can to have that manuscript done by the end of the year.
Well, that'd be great.
Yeah, we might make it. It could happen.
So what exactly does a chief scientist do all day?
Well, Gary, you see, the chief scientist is in charge of all the little Indian scientists.
Ah, I see.
Unfortunately, Fortify doesn't have any of those. So I'll tell you what a chief scientist does at a Silicon Valley startup company, which is a little bit of everything. And so that means I get to go out on the road and give talks at conferences and try and beat the software security drum.
Mm-hmm.
It means I get to go hang around with the sales guys and go and drop in on customers and aspiring customers and look at their code with them, which is a lot of fun. And probably the most fun that I get to have is when I get to hang around with our engineers and take all of the stuff that I've learned from visiting customers and going to conferences and try and help them bake it into the next round of products. So, in general, you know, if you want to see, you know, how does a startup company function, if you can get chief scientist on your business card, it's probably a pretty good way to go.
An optimal solution. So, one last question, and it's not really a geek question. What non-geek book are you currently reading?
Well, you know, actually, for this forum, I think this is a really good thing to talk about. The book that I've got open right now isn't a book at all. It's a audiobook that I bought off of the iTunes website.
Oh, good Lord.
And it is, what's the name of it? Team of Rivals.
You got to go to your computer to find out the name of it.
The name of the book is Team of Rivals, and it's about Abraham Lincoln putting together his cabinet from all of the people who competed with him for the Republican nomination.
Oh, interesting.
For the presidency.
Interesting.
And how he went about prosecuting the Civil War and all the political challenges that he faced, and how he was really a masterful politician. And I thoroughly recommend it.
Very cool. Well, thanks a lot for your time today.
Well, thank you, Gary.
This has been a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show notes, links, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.